Hey there, and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman on Chicago Tonight Black Voices. Here's what we're looking at.
We know what's best for our residents.
Just days before the ShotSpotter contract is set to expire, some city council members make a last-ditch effort to reverse course. A live report from City Hall. Last year, Illinois became the first state to end cash bail. A look at the impact on the state 1 year later.
Style is how you walk in life. You take those experiences, your cultures, the people that you love.
And trying on the history of black fashion on Chicago's South Side. And now to some of today's top stories. Rigorous, joyful, and equitable are the three words Chicago Public Schools is using to describe the school day students should be having under its new five-year strategic plan.
We have defined student success, a rigorous, joyful, and equitable daily student experience. We have also have our structure for continuous improvement, the CADT policy. So let's jump into those practices that will help us close opportunity gaps and help every student reach the ambitious goals we set with them.
Board members approved the plan at a special meeting this morning. Among the plan's goals are boosting academics for students in black and lower income neighborhoods and more support for students in temporary living situations. The plan comes at a time when the district is still negotiating its next contract with the Chicago Teachers Union and faces another projected budget deficit for next school year. In a statement, the CTU, Chicago Teachers Union, says parts of the plan mirror their current contract proposals, but says the district is fighting them at the bargaining table. Friends of the Parks says it has a few friends who agree with them in opposing the Bears' plans to build a new lakefront stadium.
As great as it would be to have a dome stadium, Chicago should not put a sold sign on our lakefront for a chance to host an event that might come around once a decade. Since 1978, a northern city has hosted a Super Bowl only twice. Detroit in 2006, Minneapolis in 2018.
The organization says its growing coalition includes longtime environmental justice advocate Cheryl Johnson, as well as Landmarks Illinois and the TIF Illumination Project. The group is using its collective power to call on the city to slow down conversations with the Bears and prioritize public engagement. Organizers have also launched a website and petition in an effort to send a message to the city and the Bears. And it is that time of the year. This Saturday at 9 a.m. kicks off the annual fall bridge lift downtown so boats can make their way to winter storage facilities. Following this weekend, bridges along the main and south branches of the Chicago River will be lifted on Saturdays and Wednesdays. And if you're downtown, be prepared. Each bridge lift takes an average of 8 to 12 minutes. Up next, City Council votes to again rebuke the mayor's decision to scrap ShotSpotter. Heather Chiron is live with that story right after this.
Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
City Council members voted 33-14 today to again endorse an effort to overturn Mayor Brandon Johnson's decision to scrap ShotSpotter, which is set to be turned off on Sunday. The vote came after another intense debate over the gunshot detection system operated by Sound Thinking. Let's listen to some of today's debate.
We know what's best for our residents. Well, African American and Latino communities are very concerned that we are playing a game of chicken with their lives right now.
I think Sound Thinking is a shoddy business. I think when they first came in, they said it was going to reduce violence, it was going to increase convictions. It did not do that. Studies show they did not do that.
WTTW News reporter Heather Chiron joins us now from outside City Hall with the latest. Heather, what exactly would this ordinance do?
Well, this ordinance is designed to give Superintendent of Police Larry Snelling the authority to contract directly with SoundThinking. And hours before today's meeting began, SoundThinking made what they hoped was an offer the city couldn't refuse. They would keep the system operational until December 31st, 2025, in return for roughly $10 million payment, which they said was about a 50% reduction. Now, their offer acknowledged that it was up to Mayor Brandon Johnson to agree to that. We heard just minutes ago that he has rejected that offer.
Heather, Alderman Jason Ervin, who represents the 28th Ward on the West Side, urged his colleagues to stop the seemingly unending debate about ShotSpotter. Let's listen to that.
Again, we got to start playing chess and not checkers, because this type of technology continues to drive community away from what needs to happen, and that is engagement with the police department.
Heather, Alderman Ervin also urged his colleagues to not vote on this ordinance, warned his colleagues from passing it, saying that it would cause chaos and was an attempt to subvert the will of the voters. Why?
Well, Mayor Brandon Johnson campaigned explicitly on ending ShotSpotter. He said it did not make South and West Side communities safer and, in fact, contributed to the over-policing of those neighborhoods. That was a tough argument for a lot of South and West Side Alder people who pleaded with Johnson to reverse course, saying that their residents, their voters, were desperate to have every tool available to the police to keep them and their families safe from violence. We also heard from Ervin that this ordinance was completely illegal and was really an unprecedented attempt to strip the mayor of his authority to contract on behalf of the city, as every other contract in Chicago has been.
Heather, what is the likelihood that Johnson reverses course?
Zero. We heard minutes ago that he will issue his first ever veto of this ordinance. That ensures that the system will be turned off on Sunday. Once he issues that veto, a little bit of Chicago history for you. It will be the first mayoral veto since 2006, when former Mayor Richard M. Daley vetoed an effort that would have required so-called big box stores like Walmart that were just coming to Chicago to pay their employees more. Truly historic moment today in City Hall.
2006, Heather. So what happens next?
Well, we're going to see a lot of debate about whether the end of ShotSpotter is going to contribute to an increase in gun violence and deaths on the city's south and west sides. The company said that it helps Chicago police get to gunshot victims faster than they otherwise would. So if we see gunfire and gunshot deaths increase on the south and the west sides, Mayor Brandon Johnson is going to wear the jacket for making the decision that he made today.
All right, something we'll be keeping an eye on, obviously. Heather Sharone at City Hall for us. Thank you. And we've been reporting on the ShotSpotter contract in the back and forth with the mayor and some Alder people for months. So if you're looking for background and some more context on ShotSpotter and other complicated issues facing our city, you can check out our email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan. You can sign up at WTTW.com/newsletter. We're back with more right after this. Illinois became the first state to eliminate cash bail exactly 1 year ago today. The Pretrial Fairness Act meant most defendants would remain free with court conditions rather than spend time in jail until they could post bond. Supporters say the law is intended to address equity issues, while opponents feared a spike in crime. New research paints a preliminary picture. Joining us now are Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox and on Zoom, Clay County State's Attorney Philip Givens. Thanks to you both for joining us. Kim Fox, starting with you, please. Do you think the Pretrial Fairness Act has accomplished what you wanted it to?
Certainly, the preliminary results are very promising. What we knew was that cash bail was not an indicator of public safety, that people who were charged with violent offenses who could get access to cash were allowed to walk free, while others who were charged with nonviolent offenses would spend time in jail until they could post bond. And what we've seen in the 1 year that we've been doing this is that we've not seen an increase in crime, which a lot of detractors were trying to use as a cudgel to not support this legislation. And we've also seen people returning for their court dates, which is the intended purpose of bond. And so I think the preliminary results are very promising. It's early. Certainly there's things that we want to continue to look at and see for trends. But right now, I think it is having its intended effect.
And we're going to get into some of that data as well. Phil Givens, how do you think it's gone?
I think for Cook County, that's probably all true. But for the downstate Illinois, where I am, I don't feel that it's the preliminary numbers don't fit what I foresee happening in the long term. I think that getting rid of cash bail has, while maybe not decreased crime or increased crime, it's remained the same. And what we are failing to mention is that criminals, although they do stupid things and commit crimes, they're also somewhat savvy, and they are aware that a new law came out where they don't have to post bail, and they are learning what they can do and what they can't do to remain out and not have to go back in custody. That does not necessarily mean they are being held accountable as they should, and it doesn't mean that overall crime's going to continue to trend anywhere downward.
Phil Givens, you were also part of the original lawsuit that opposed the Pretrial Fairness Act. Among your concerns was a lack of control for prosecutors and for judges. Have you seen that lack of control or perceived lack of control play out in courtrooms?
Absolutely, at least once a week. The most frustrating part of not only my job, especially down here, and law enforcement, as well as judges, is that we're being told what offenses are detainable and what offenses are not detainable. I'll give you a prime example, a class 4 possession of fentanyl, a very deadly drug, where a grain of salt of it is a class 4 felony. However, that grain of salt for a non-drug user, if it goes anywhere near someone else, they will die. So that is very concerning that that offense is not detainable. We can't even argue that the person wouldn't appear in court. We couldn't argue whether or not they've had several failures to appear because it's a class 4 felony. That is tying our hands. It's very frustrating whenever we have a community that has drug epidemics, especially in Southern Illinois, that we have to look to our community and say, unfortunately, there's nothing we can do. That was one of the main concerns that I had moving forward with this legislation.
Another one of your concerns was the crime rates. So we mentioned the data, of course, analyzed by the Loyola Center for Criminal Justice that shows comparing the first 6 months of 2023 with the first 6 months of 2024, violent crime decreased by about 7.5%, property crimes 14% for a total of 12%. A little over 12% is what they're saying. Phil Givens, it sounds like you're not seeing that reflected in Clay County.
I'm not. You know, I don't really see a difference in terms of violent crimes as opposed to what we had before. You know, the sad part about violent crimes is violent crimes are listed as also like class 3 aggravated battery of a child. If there's no great bodily harm on that child, I can't detain them. The presumption is to let that defendant go. I can try to argue a threat of great bodily harm, but how is that anywhere near something that's helpful? You know, from what I'm seeing, is there's a pretty consistent trend of our crimes are the same. Law enforcement's getting frustrated because some of the stuff that we would be able to hold someone on even for a little while, because what people fail to mention that before the Pretrial Fairness Act went into effect, on these class 3s and 4s where they did have a low bond, they were getting $30 a day. So while they were in custody, if they had jobs, if they had things going for them, if they had ways, we got to use our discretion in terms of where that was at in the crime that we had. We also got to use our discretion in how much of a bond we would ask for. Judges had that discretion to set it, and they got $30 a day. So they were getting out. It's not like they were spending months and months in jail.
Kim Fox,
so, you know, that's something that we don't talk about.
So if Cook County being very different from downstate Clay County, more rural, the types of crimes that are being prosecuted there, and the people somewhat different than what you're seeing here in Cook County, is this the kind of law that can have widespread application across the state? And obviously, we can't have different rules for different counties.
Absolutely. We've seen that play out over the last year. I respectfully, with the Clay County State's Attorney, that's not what I'm hearing bearing out in the data across the state. In fact, I just read from the Chief Judge of St. Clair County, which is downstate Illinois, who said that the elimination of cash bail has been going very well, that they are able to detain the people who need to be detained and people who need to go free are free. The data that you cited to the state's attorney is statewide data. It's not just Cook County data. It is statewide data. And the purposes of bail, to be clear, cash bail was someone who was a danger to the community or a flight risk. And what part of the fear-mongering that happened in the lead-up to the implementation of the Pretrial Fairness Act was that crime was going to go up. So when I hear my colleagues say, well, no, crime hasn't gone up, then what we're telling me is that cash bail didn't determine people committing more crimes. You're telling me that by saying that that hasn't happened. And in fact, crime has gone down. No one is saying that the Pretrial Fairness Act is causing crime to go down. No one can make that claim. But what we are saying is that if cash were the determinant of who was a danger to the community, and we've eliminated that from the equation, and we've not seen a rise in crime, then there was not a necessity to do that. And so certainly wanting to be able to evaluate these cases on an individual basis to hold people who should be held and make sure that we have the list of detainable offenses that are fair and equitable. But I think it's disingenuous to say that statewide this has not been a success based on the research that has come in so far.
Research also shows that the length of pretrial hearings has increased from 4 minutes to 16 minutes. What's getting accomplished in these hearings that takes more time that wasn't happening before?
Well, certainly, first of all, I have to remind folks that people who are charged with crimes by the state's attorneys in their various counties are presumed to be innocent. And so part of this is requiring state's attorneys to show what evidence that we will be able to present. It is having an opportunity for witnesses, if there need to be there, to come forward. It has the opportunity for us to have victims, for example, in cases of domestic violence. We're seeing more instances with people charged with domestic violence being detained in ways that we weren't seeing prior to the Pretrial Fairness Act. There's more opportunity for the defense to present mitigation. And most importantly, the judge has to make a record, a clear record about why someone is being detained or what conditions that they need. And so it's a more thoughtful process. And I would say it's absolutely necessary to be that thoughtful because we are detaining people who are innocent until proven guilty and denying them their access to freedom. And while I can imagine that $30 a day may seem robust for some, that does not equate to what it means to deny someone their freedom pre-trial to participate in their defense when they've not been convicted of a crime.
You mentioned some of the quote-unquote fear-mongering that happened in advance of the Pretrial Fairness Act. In as recently as last week, you said some of that opposition was straight-up racist.
I did indeed. Listen, we can have disagreement, and certainly the Clay County State's Attorney was a part of a coalition of state's attorneys across the state who filed legal action to prevent the implementation of the Pretrial Fairness Act. And that matter was heard in court, went all the way up to the Supreme Court. As litigators, we should be able to litigate. What I saw, however, was language like the purge. What I saw was Darren Bailey and Dan Proft send out newspapers, fake newspapers, that had on the cover faces of black and brown men, darkened, saying that Chicago's problems are coming to your neighborhood. The rhetoric that was used around what this would mean and what would happen on that first day was absolutely steeped in race. And it is something, quite honestly, that I brought up to the Illinois State's Attorneys Association because I was quite offended as the only black state's attorney in the state of Illinois to see that type of rhetoric. Again, we can have policy debates, But using phrases like the purge, sending out flyers with darkened faces of black men, was rooted in something deeper than a policy disagreement. And I feel that it's necessary to call a thing a thing.
According to the Loyola data that we've been referring to, monitoring 77 counties, prosecutors did not petition to have someone detained in 43% of cases in which they could. Phil Givens, does that show that the list of detainable offenses is broad enough? Is that something you would like to see?
I would like to see the detainable offenses broaden a little bit more. Mainly, I'll give you a prime example. One I would like to see on there is aggravated battery of a peace officer. You charge an aggravated battery of a peace officer, which is a class 2 felony, if the person doesn't have a history of willful flight, that's non-detainable. Now, what does that tell our law enforcement? That while you're doing your job, someone can shove you to the ground. While you're doing your job, they can punch you in the face. As long as it's not great bodily harm, as long as you just get a bruise, we can't hold them. Now, that's in no way, shape, or form any form of racism, any form of anything. The way I look at it in the issues with the Pretrial Fairness Act, and I do agree with one thing that Mrs. Fox said. What it has done is we do take more time in terms of detaining someone. A simple probable cause statement, a simple probable cause information written by an officer was all it took before. I will agree with that I do actually appreciate the fact that we do get to put more on the record and the judge does get to hear more, which when we ask to detain someone, there's a reason. And I like to take into effect that I believe my colleagues, Mrs. Fox included, when you look to detain someone, there's a reason. And I believe that we would set bonds and ask for bonds at certain prices and heights for the same reason.
Okay.
Now, just one more thing, real quick. Mrs. Fox, I saw, was quoted at one point in saying that people lose their jobs if they're detained. With cash bail on domestic batteries and things like that, if there wasn't a serious physical harm, they were able to post just the same as being detained now, or we let them out. What we do is look at the similarities, and we try to do the best we can for not only our side, but I was a defense attorney too. We're in the best interest of justice, and that's what we're here for.
It sounds like, obviously, it is not. None of it is done without complications, without a lot of thought from you and the teams that both of you work with. Sadly, that is where we'll have to leave it. We could talk about it all day, but maybe there'll be another opportunity down the road. Phil Givens in Clay County, Kim Fox, Cook County. Thank you so much for both of you.
Thank you.
We're back with more right after this, but first, a look at the weather. Furs, tailored suits, colorful threads, and stitching. Those were just some of the fashion trends dating back to the 1930s. Now, two friends are combining their love of fashion by incorporating film and the runway to explore what black fashion looked like on Chicago's South Side decades ago. The show is called Chicago Style. We recently met with the artists to learn more about their vision.
The biggest thing I'm learning is just the culture behind fashion. So back then, one of the things Ayanna was telling us is that most of the clothes were tailored. So maybe they couldn't go into that Marshall Fields, but what they would do is see the image of this dress they wanted, go back to their community and have it made for them. And so everything was tailored. And even when you went outside to go grocery shopping or go to somebody's house, you always had the best fit on. That was your runway. The streets, the community was your runway.
The cultural aspect of it was community. And that was one thing that, especially now, that we find kind of fleeting. And looking back in those days with Southside Homebrew Projects, looking at those film, you know, it just brings you back to those times, you know, when community were together, when the mom and pop grocery stores, all those things were together. And now today, you know, it's so saturated, our communities are gentrified, and you know, and the community is kind of our young kids kind of out of touch with a lot of things. So what this did is kind of like a Sankofa, kind of reached back, you know, to bring back all those feel-good memories.
if you go around Chicago, you see a lot of pictures of just our history. You see the young boys on the car. You see people going to church. And these portraits are just in Chicago shops. They're in Chicago homes. And so one of the pictures we saw was a young kid that had this really triangular lapel jacket on. And we didn't know if the kid was a boy or a girl. So we were like, okay, that's beautiful. We would love to mimic that. So the top half of this kind of mimics that.
Everyone thinks it started with Beyonce, but no. You know, we're mimicking things like Jackie Stallone and Olivia Newton-John back in the 80s during those times when they, you know, somebody threw heels on and turned this whole thing into a fashion craze.
Style is how you walk in life. You take those experiences, your cultures, the people that you love, and that's what influences your style. And so I want people to just know that they are a part of history.
These type of events, especially these fashion shows, can actually hopefully plant that seed, you know, to kind of open up, to kind of restart these mom and pop stores, the dressmakers and the tailors and the cobbler and all those things, you know, hopefully can start that.
And with support from the Illinois Humanities Nonprofit and other organizations, the duo is bringing their vision to life this Saturday with a free fashion show at the Green Lights Performing Arts Center in Washington Park. You can visit our website to learn more. And that's our show for this Wednesday night. Catch us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Fears this election cycle about an immigrant crime wave, but what do the numbers actually say? Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to give back to its community in Chicago and beyond.